What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
The final four episodes of All the President's Minutes on One Heat Minute Productions feed are brought to you by Belly Catering. Bellycatering.com.au is where you can find one of Sydney's greatest catering companies. They've pivoted to home delivery, but they're getting back some catering gigs. They're coming back. We love you, Belly Catering. We love you, Glenn and Maria, and the entire family and team. Thank you so much for being on this ride with us this entire year. 137 episodes, 120 plus hours of discussion of this 1976 masterpiece would not have been able to be done without you. So thank you so much. Also brought to you by everything we're doing on One Heat Meter Productions. Increment Vice has just wrapped up its 45 episodes. It Came from the Deep, an audiobook and after show in its very own feed is happening. Of course, Miami Nice still continues popping into your feed sporadically to inject a little bit of Colin Farrell into your life and some Gong Li dancing and some terrific Katie Walsh, Maria Lewis, Travis Woods, Kat Corbett, the entire team at One Minute Productions. Thanks you. Now here's the goddamn story.
And now that I've made the film, it's impossible for me to imagine making the film without Bob and Dustin. And what happened was, the insecurity is there, the fear is there. I mean, the scenes with Deep Throat, when you see Bob is intimidated by Deep Throat. He's afraid of asking the wrong questions. You feel it in his relationship with Bradley. You feel them as young men struggling with something that is way beyond anything they've ever touched in their lives and possibly beyond anything they ever will touch in their lives, and trying to measure up to what is demanded of them. And that's part of the fascination of the film.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. It's episode 136. There is less than 2 minutes to go before credits. This is the person who's talking the last full minute of this show. And if people have listened to One Heat Minute, you would know that as part of a gargantuan four-part aperitif to Michael Mann coming onto the show, I invited one of the great fans of the show that had been such an amazing supporter. That person was John Glynn, who you would have heard recently on one of our episodes. But this time, I just want to call him a mammoth supporter of the show, and someone who I've been having a dialogue since he discovered the show, having a dialogue with that is almost like my sanity check of how good the show is going. Because if this guest and I are emailing back and forth fun things or talking about stuff, it means that I'm doing good. When I do these shows, I do them for the people out there who see this beacon the brightest and go, holy shit, this is a movie that I'm as obsessed with as anyone else in the world. I never even imagined that there would be someone out there that's as obsessed with this movie as me. And so when I find those kinds of people, I want to talk to them on the show. As everyone would know by now, Jane Alexander is part of the show in the final episode. So I hope you're looking forward to that. I know my guest is who I'm talking to today. But my guest also, because I literally have the best supporters in the whole world, manually hacked a teletype machine, interfaced it with his computer for his own amusement, and started having a teletype come out of the headlines of the news of the day. And then because he's just an incredibly generous human being with his time, went and then hacked that thing again to make a teletype that would announce the final parts of this show. You would have seen parts of the first bits of that by now on social media. It's my distinct pleasure to talk to someone who I now consider a friend, who just quietly used to be, is the former vice president of human interface at a little fruit company called Apple, was in charge of a couple of things, designing the iPhone, designing the iPad, developing OS 10, you know, just those small fundamental cultural shifting things, and just happens to be an ultra fan of All the President's Men. And fortunately enough, a fan of All the President's Minutes. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome Greg Christie to the show. Greg, thank you so much for being a part of it.
Oh, sure. My pleasure, Blake.
So here we are. We're right now in the final moments. We've got the guns firing off in the distance, a 21-gun salute. Nixon is being inaugurated. We've got these guys clattering away at their typewriters right now. Tell me and tell the folks listening why you love this movie so much.
Why is super hard. You know, I think a lot of your guests have struggled with the actual whys. It's just, it's always been there for me. This movie came out when I was 10, going on 11. I remember my sisters going to see it and coming home and talking about it. I saw it later that year. Watergate was a huge deal in my house growing up.
Yes.
We were kind of a split family politically. And I remember seeing the Watergate hearings, the Senate hearings, when I was 8 years old, just running that whole summer. And I guess a few years after I saw that movie, I read the book for the first time. Then, oddly enough, in high school, I saw The Candidate, Redford's 72
great movie.
Film.
Great movie.
Which, you know, dovetails straight into this. And
has one of the greatest final lines of any movie ever, which is...
Oh, yeah, this became a pack. Phrase to us. What do we do now?
What do we do now?
It's like whenever something good would happen, we look at each other and say, what do we do now? You know? The Candidate's funny because I think it's an interesting double feature with this movie. I mean, aside from Redford being in both, and you know, if you listen to the commentary on All the President's Men, Redford talks about, you know, how he discovered the reporting of Woodward and Bernstein while doing a press tour. For The Candidate.
Yeah.
And my kids are one's 22, one's 18, and you know, I forced them to watch All the President's Men and The Candidate. My youngest, my 18-year-old, he says, do movies in the 70s, do they all just end? Do they all just stop? His impression is that, you know, in these movies, you like run out of film and then call it done. <'Cause they're, laughs> you know, but
he's, you know what, if you're his age and like Netflix has existed at the same time as your burgeoning interest of things, and like everything is serialized, even with the Marvel Cinematic Universes and DC and all that, like you totally would go, sorry, there's four more episodes of this, is there not? Like, can you just clarify that for me? Or I totally get that impulse. I totally get it. But I love it. Do they just stop?
The candidate ends, you know, are they squished into a room or is it an elevator? And, you know, and it's just Redford saying, what do we do now? And then it's credits. I mean, it's like,
it's beautiful.
You know,
God damn. How good is Peter Boyle? Talk about another actor who's, you know, just like all the wonderful actors in this movie. But Peter Boyle as a cynical, wily fox of a guy, holy shit. Can he act the pants off of almost anyone at that time in the 70s? My goodness.
Amazing. And this, I think the only other movie I had seen, you know, so I was, what, 13, 14. The only other movie I had seen with him, of course, was Young Frankenstein.
Oh.
Where he's the monster.
Name a better career. Name a better career than Young Frankenstein, The Candidate, Taxi Driver, and then Everybody Loves Raymond, where you can just like sit there for the rest of your life being like the source, one of the primary sources of laughter for just decades. What a killer. What an absolute legend. Holy dooly. But yeah, The Candidate, I had a weird experience because I'd never seen The Candidate until this year doing this project. And so people had always talked about The Candidate and a lot of materials are coming up, you know, those stories you're reading, The Candidate. And such is life in Oz, especially during the time of COVID. There are some great great old school video stores that still exist in some sort of like trendier inner city, you know, really? Inner eastern city suburbs. Yeah, there's a place called Film Club in Sydney who's still very much keeping physical media as a rental alive. And then libraries were closed. So I was like, you know, there's the possibility you could find some old stuff on libraries. But then I just got on the old VPN and started renting some things from United States iTunes. Right. And I got The Candidate because it was just like, I just wanted to put a few of these things together. And I just saw it and I was completely struck by, there's a scene in The Candidate, not just the ending that is wonderful, but there's a moment where in the middle of it, Redford, who is playing a political candidate, that Peter Boyle is essentially designing on the fly. Like I'm talking to you as a man who's designing things, like he's literally designing and patching this person to be the perfect political mouthpiece and candidate. And there's a moment where it's like, you know, to talk in the terms of like a science fiction almost, is like he becomes self-aware and he starts sitting in a car talking to himself, drinking his own Kool-Aid, and he's driving along. And I had to rewind that scene and watch it multiple times because Redford going inside the game was so amazing. It was like, oh, that's the moment.
He starts scrambling his stump speech, right? He starts piecing different parts of it together.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Wonderful.
That's fantastic. The other thing I really loved about that movie was the subtle way they presented the affair that he was having.
Just played it.
See this woman once, you see her again, and here in the 21st century, we're thinking, is she a stalker? Is, you know, is she a criminal? And then, you know, there's the slight reveal of him coming out of her hotel room. And it's just, it's so understated.
And they didn't even mention it. They didn't even, no, she barely, I think maybe she requests for a photo. But I haven't seen it, you know, like Presidents where I can recall things instantly or Pete, I can say no, yes or no, that didn't happen. I think she may have one line. If it's one line, it's around a photograph. You don't really get any words from her, but I just love his whole team just sort of see that happen. They observe it. They process it in their brain and then it's just gone. It's like, okay, that happened.
That's fantastic.
Good movie. I love that. Did in the 70s. I just really love to think they ran out of film. All right, put the credits on. That's enough. it's the best.
And, you know, I mean, of course, the same is true with Presidents.
Exactly. You know, I heard a great thing on the Slate podcast, working with a guest that we'd had on this show, actually, who I was lucky enough to talk to, Isaac Butler. And he came on the show, you know, now is like 50 or so minutes ago. And he interviewed Phil Alden Robinson about the movie Sneakers. And he told a great story. Be a Beacon. Oh, one of the funniest scenes in all cinema, that scene. But he talked about they shot an ending of Sneakers where at sunup in the Bay Area, the whole crew drive down in a car to a wharf and they grab the chip and they toss it into the water. And this is after the great scene where they relinquish it from Sir Ben Kingsley. And they drive away. And he said he was watching it in the edit and he's like, this sucks. And his editor was like, to Phil Alden Robinson, what are we going to do? And he goes, I want to see him use it. And so he called in a favor from a friend at a newsroom that said, when you finish the news tonight, I'll send you dialogue to put in a teleprompter. Can you read it? Have someone capture it there on film, put it on a tape, send it through me via Express Post. He said, so we reshot the ending for $27 in postage. That's how they fixed the ending.
The ending of that movie is supposed archival footage, right? It's on the television.
It's on the television. So they got
just like Nixon getting inaugurated.
Exactly. So it's just like that moment where it's like sometimes an archival footage that is giving you the information, telling you what you kind of want to hear, see, but letting that rest in the sort of depths of your imagination, or in the case of this film, because it's, you know, I don't think there's anything more exciting than the Republican Party declaring the GOP declaring their bankruptcy and then I think it was like the and then I think it was Young African American Fund or something like that was getting had received these huge anonymous donations, and you know, that's enough. Like, it's just this couple of florid lines about what they would have fun doing with that money, and that's it. It's beautiful. It's just a beautiful little moment. And in this movie right now, obviously much more calculated, much more pressure tested, but Robert L. Wolf, like, the ending of this movie was not meant to be a teletype. It was, and perhaps it influenced what the scene that we're watching right now. It was meant to be a kind of a poetic allusion, a recall to the beginning, which would have, rather than seeing a helicopter descend and Nixon entering for this sort of State of the Union speech, a helicopter flying away with Nixon post-resignation flying away. And the editor, Robert L. Wolf, according to John Boorstin, who was part of the show, said, that's too on the nose.
Yeah.
Let's just make it a teletype.
Did Boorstin say whether they were going to do the same approach, you know, the montage, the headlines only in video?
No, it was not
going to. It was just going to, like, smash cut.
Nixon waving goodbye in the helicopter, and helicopter ascending, because we'd seen the helicopter descend, and there's all that sort of florid, isn't it amazing? He's traveled from the Atlantic, da, 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 da. It's like Nixon resigning and then going up in the air. But he's like, nah, it's too showy, too ramming at home. There's a better ending for this. And it's just these guys, him being inaugurated, them continuing to work. And here we are approaching the 136, the second last minute of this film, the whole last whole minute of the movie.
It's still like media to media bookends, right? I mean, you start with the new media of television.
Yes.
You know, circa 1972, it's the new media. And then it ends with the traditional media. Old media wins, right?
Yes. Yes, it does.
With the hammering of the teletype. I mean, it's not them typing, it's the teletype itself. So it's, you know, it's done. It's fact. It's being published. It's not them working.
No, the work has been done. The foundations that they're laying right now allow for that beautiful chaos. There is a beautiful chaos to a teletype, just that beautiful chaos. Bang, 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 bang. Just punctuating. And you and I have talked off air about your project with this teletype that you own, about how much I crave it. And we've even talked off air, which I think we can talk about, is, you know, how much that a front page or the results of a teletype, you cannot beat them for how succinctly you receive the information and what is actually important for you to know to be a functioning and educated member of society.
Right.
That doesn't exist in our virtual world nearly in any of the same way.
You know, I'd say about 15 years ago, you as a consumer actually had more control over your digital content. There's this mechanism called RSS feeds. It's the same mechanism that is behind, you know, podcast notifications. It was used for news stories, and you could subscribe to, you know, the Times RSS feeds or the LA Times feeds or Reuters, Associated Press, and these things could all be aggregated.
Yes. Right?
So you were in control of, like, your own personal front page, so to speak. And we at Apple, we had that built into the web browser Safari. There was a really robust RSS support, right, for people to assemble their own, you know, personal front pages, for lack of a better term, you know, for whatever the current news was. And it was just the headlines, or you could control how much of the story body you saw. You know, maybe it's a headline and a couple of lines.
Yeah.
And you could smash that together, and you could look at one thing, you know, whether it was, you know, across a variety of subjects, or you could sort it out into, like, different, you know, tabs in your browser. And then I think it was around 2012, Apple pulled that support out of the web browser. So I basically built my own. I built my own RSS aggregator. And it was just a simple web page on my own home server that I would, you know, go into from my computer. I mean, this is or phone or iPad. And it was, again, just the headlines. And then I started, I don't know how much this movie, you know, the ending of this movie inspired me, or just this notion, but of a news wire, a traditional news wire. And then I found a surplus printer and hooked it up to a computer and got it to spit out just the headlines, you know, from this, these headlines that I was aggregating already. I actually have every headline from Reuters, Associated Press, Washington Post, and CNN going back to 2012 archived.
Oh my God.
As a side effect of this project. So, you know, if you want to know what the truth is or see, you know, just to me and I'll let you know. I mean, for example, I mean, from earlier this year, Reuters and the Washington Post were both referring to coronavirus as the China virus. Not quoting somebody saying that, but they themselves were calling it the China virus. So, you know.
Yep.
This is what happens when you have the truth in print. You can't take it back.
You can't take it back. It's
Anyway, so then I just ended up finding this machine, and it needed a little work, not much, but it needed some work, and then hooking it up. So it clatters and bangs, and the bells ring when new stories
the bells.
Come in. And,
great.
Yeah. You know, it's just a mechanical bell would be a great thing to have.
It's you know, we've talked about it on this show a few times, and why I'm talking about it with Greg is because, you know, there is just something about a great tactile physical front page that really no online version of any paper gets for some reason. And you find all these stupid things that you have to do. You know, it starts being like, oh, even though I subscribe to this and I subscribe to that, it's then actually going and following their Twitter feed sometimes. Some of the companies have got their own Twitter feed about what the headline news is. So then you follow that and you put notifications on your Twitter so that like you get a notification when there's a headline story from the publications that you follow, whether it be like the Times or the Post or the LA Times or whatever, just so that you can like go, okay, cool. And in Australia, my most trusted news outlet in this country is our national broadcaster, the ABC. So like I go to ABC News and that's my, I'm like, okay, cool. You know, you go in there because if you're on a Facebook and there are these, you know, Murdoch press propagandist sort of outlooks for everything, whenever anyone used to send me things when I used to have a Facebook, since I've now deleted it, but when people would send me things, I'd just go into the ABC and actually read the story that had the facts. And then I'd go, okay, well, this is the story. And move away from that sort of tone. But there's just nothing like that front page. All that stuff above the fold, we don't want to stick it inside someplace. We want it all to be right on that front page.
I mean, it's clear from a design perspective that's what you want. It's clear from the user or the consumer perspective that's what you want. I have to think that it's somehow or in some way at odds with whatever business model these news organizations have evolved. Because there's no other reason not to present stuff digitally the same way that it has been, you know, successfully been presented for hundreds of years now. I mean, the newspaper was a pretty refined, perfected form of presentation in terms of, you know, the information hierarchy, the way stuff was laid out on the 2D grid. It was the stuff above the fold or below the fold and, you know, or buried inside, as Bradley says. And, you know, there's no technological reason, there's no design reason why that couldn't work on especially the high resolution displays everybody has with them today. You know,
indeed.
It could work.
I mean, you are preaching to the choir. I think especially in the time of, you know, COVID and this year and how, you know, the water torture of ongoing news cycles and then often being at home. And so there's no, you know, I remember, you know, times in the office in my old job, you're usually like flat out, you're meeting with people, you're discussing things, you're working, you're collaborating with individuals like face to face, and you're not looking at your phones and you guys don't have time to consume other screens. And sometimes you might pass by and depending on whatever the company's got on, there'll be something on the screen, some kind of 24-hour news on a screen that you can see a little, you know, the ticker tape going across the screen and maybe get a headline. But that changes when you're at home. You're like second screening constantly. You might have two screens up. There are things happening. There's news running. You've got your options. And I just think that like, I would love I would love the option to just go, what are the front page stories of the day? Really deep dive and consume on, you know, that few pages of and all of that important stuff, and then be able to go, bye. I don't need to see that. Like, I'll check the 6 o'clock news tonight, you know, like, and I'll watch on television or check back in for the, you know, the late breaking stories. But man, people just want that, just the facts, you know, they want that. They're yearning for it. And it's, and we're doing all these silly things to do, to curate it and find it. But I think to your point, something that was successful and perfected over 150 years is something maybe is a good starting point.
It would seem that way.
All right. Well, let's go to this minute, 2 hours, 15 minutes on your dial. We're in the post newsroom. It's a split diopter shot is where we're starting, which you wouldn't have it any other way, would you?
No.
A split diopter shot of the boys, Robert Redford.
I'm one of the lucky 40 that got a split
diopter. You're in the top 40 split diopter shots in all the presidents. Yeah, Gordy Willis, he loves a split diopter, but it's extremely effective here. And just in the transition of shots, these guys appearing by themselves, then the television all constantly in the foreground, they're working. We've pushed in on these guys into this hum, into this noise. There's not only the noise from the television, the noise from all these other people, the noise that they're creating, typing out these stories. But now we're sort of drilling into these guys. We've been distracted by the 21-gun salute, by Nixon's conviction. Yes, I solemnly swear, you know, all that stuff. But let's watch this minute right now and really just see the signature of this movie and the signature style of all of the wonderful artisans. And, you know, two Uber fans are going to watch this minute together for you right now, and then we're going to come back and talk all about it. There it is.
Wow.
We this is our jump to 1975, March 13. Stands admits guilt. I'm guessing that is going to say guilt.
Good. So we got it all here. We got televisions, we got typewriters, we got teletypes.
And
if we had talking and telephones, we'd have all of the T's in the movie.
All of the T's. And ties, really thick ties. So we get some thick ties in there. But I love the hierarchy of information here, as you said. So you've got televisions, you've then got the typewriters, the guys doing their thing. Dissolves edit choices are something that are like, they can be really rote and terribly used, or they can be so perfectly used. And I think here, I love the dissolve.
Is this the only cross dissolve in the movie?
There's one other one. There's one other one that occurs.
Where?
It's, I have to recall, I'm just trying to think of the moment, but there's one other dissolve in the movie and I'm trying to think of where it is. This may be, let's just say arguably this is the single dissolve and until I remember, but yeah, it's the choice for a dissolve is incredible. And especially one split diopter into another, dissolving into another split diopter shot, because you can see the blur on the top of Redford's typewriter. But just again, the Woodward, the Bernstein badges in full view, those guys basically feel like they're complete equals in the frame. It's just a great little composition to show them just tirelessly working, not looking at anything else except for what they're writing. And it's just great. After all the other noise and Nixon's conviction, it's like, doesn't matter to these two. They're just going to keep working. It's beautiful.
Done, and they're, you know, they're facing each other, right? They're face to face, but set apart by depth with the split diopter. We can see them both, and they're just banging away on the typewriters. I mean, well, first of all, you know I'm obsessed with the televisions, with the use of televisions in this.
I love that you are. Yeah, and I love that. And also, it's a great use of archival footage just in general. And and also when they come in and how they're peppered throughout the movie, they're just great.
I think clearly in 76, the TV stuff served as a touch point, a touchstone for, you know, contemporary audiences. This is what you saw. Remember you saw this? This is what was happening behind the scenes when you saw this.
Yes.
You know, but today, you know, almost 50 years later, it has an almost like Terry Gilliam, like a 12 Monkeys or Brazil kind of feel to it, because it's so different. And it's this other world. It's not the world of our characters, right?
No.
It's this mediated world inside the little box. And so it's just, it has a very abstract kind of feeling to it now.
And the one or two times it feels like it's universally either for PR or for propaganda in the way that it's deployed in the movie. And the one moment that it isn't like that is with that great female sort of talk show journo starts interrogating using the lines from the Watergate. Like, did you know that this happened? You know, did you know this? And actually asking really tactical follow-up questions to get an admission live on air. No, we did not. And that's the only time
of Klein Dines, then Attorney General, right? The Attorney General who followed John Mitchell.
Who followed Mitchell. And so Klein Dines we see here in the teletype, but that Klein Dines interrogation that happens is the other moment where you're like, oh, TV can help. Because everything other than that point has been like, oh, look at Richard Nixon. Isn't it amazing that he can fly on this chopper? Isn't that wonderful? And then the next one is like, you know, all these denials from everyone, every man and their dog, actual denials with Sloan, you know, like, you know, that, you know, recreation of archival footage. But that moment where that reporter has got Kleindienst on his heels and says, did you know that people were burning things? And he says, no, I did not. It's like, oh, well, hand in glove, our story is penetrating, because in this PR BS propagandistic medium, they can actually ask the pertinent questions. And now, obviously, paradigms have shifted, and it really depends on what network you're looking at and what countries and different places, you know, what authority they have. But it's like, those rigorous investigative journalists and stuff like that sometimes still only exist in the landscape of TV. In my country, there's a great investigative program that is like an equivalent of like a Spotlight. It's one of the only programs that kind of exists, called Four Corners. They've been going for about 30 years, and they've taken down state and local government officials, and they've taken down some big, taken down some big fish in their variety of investigations. And really, they're kind of one of the last ones doing it. But in this movie, I love how you said the TV is the distraction, and in the background, there's the real work is being done.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. And so we go from the TV to the typing and the typing and the typing and the typing. The whole time the guns are being fired.
Yes.
That's never completely out of the audio mix. It's there underneath it. Even when we switch the focus to the typing, and then of course to the teletype.
We finish that 21 gun salute, Greg. We finish it.
The gunfire just continues. Right? You know, and I think you said several times on the show, words are weapons, right?
Yeah. Well, they are for these guys now.
This is a war movie, and the weapons are work.
Yeah, an Australian, great Australian satirist, Charles Firth, from our satire troupe called The Chaser, a very famous group in Oz. He literally goes, this movie feels to me like an action movie. He goes, I watched it recently, and he's like, you got Hoffman running through a newsroom. It feels like he's running through, like darting through, you know, he feels like he's darting through traffic. And he's like, and these guys are typing, and it feels like gunfire. There's guns firing everywhere. He goes, it just feels like, you know, the typewriters are the weapons too. The words are the weapons, and absolutely the typewriters are, you know, the words might be the bullets, and the typewriters might be all of the artillery, basically. It's just, you know, being fired throughout this movie. But I think it's a great observation, and it's, you know, it doesn't surprise me that Goldman has the smarts to like build in the structure of like, because it is like these guys are at war. These guys are in an impossible war the whole time. It's a war for their morality and it's a war for the future of the country. And even though Bradley shrugs it off very casually, he knows how important what they're doing is for this moment. And in an alternate dark timeline, Greg, you know, you'll hear this on the show, is this would have been my emphatic, you know, plea to people if Donald Trump had won a second term. It's like, hey, Nixon won a second term too, guys, and was inaugurated. That doesn't mean the work stops. It means you keep working. It means you keep typing. But maybe now, you know, all hope would have been lost. I don't know. What a dark timeline indeed.
Oh, God, just the thought.
Well, thankfully, we're in this much lighter timeline.
This movie,
he still loves those shenanigans. I think as of today, the day we're recording, he's 0-33. So 33 defeats at the different courts around the country. So 0-33, I think, is pretty emphatic.
Not only that, and I think this event will be lost to the mist of time, thank goodness, but he took part in a fake government hearing.
Excuse me?
Yes, he took part in a fake government hearing today. Giuliani held basically a press event at a hotel in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, you know, not far from the Battle of Gettysburg, right? Symbolic location.
Yes.
And the invited members of that conference were members of the Pennsylvania State Legislature from the Republican Party. And it was billed as a state hearing, a Pennsylvania state government hearing.
Is this what I've been seeing while I've been recording today, where someone's holding up a phone where he's talking?
Yes. And El Trumpo called in. And so for about 10 minutes.
I've seen The Godfather Part 2. I don't think they would have let Michael Corleone call in to the Senate hearings. I just don't think it would happen.
That's because that's a scene that features an actual government hearing as opposed to, you know, an event staged for television and for retweeting. And this was not, I mean, it didn't take place in the Pennsylvania State House. It wasn't organized by any, you know, recognized part of the Pennsylvania state government, but it was billed as a hearing. So we
right. Have, don't hearings have, take place in courts?
Courts or, you know,
Senate floors,
senatorial conference rooms, right? You know, the Watergate hearings did not take place in a hotel.
No. Or a cafe.
And those were actual functions of an actual government. It's just bizarre. It's you know, I mean, a lot of, you know, he's often called the reality TV star. And this is just unreality, but staged as though it's reality television. It's just, I mean, it just turns my stomach. It's been turning my stomach for, you know, 5 years since this guy's been on TV every day.
Oh, man. Talk about wishing you could just go back to physical media with this guy, because like, you know, with sound bites and retweets and things, it's just like, he's been an inescapable force in everyone's timeline. And it's just like, get out of here. I don't want him in here. I don't want to listen to this nonsense. He drives me insane. I don't even live in the damn country.
We could turn the page, right?
Yeah. You just turn the page or you see a quote and you see that editorial policy would say, these are the things that this politician said, and these are all the factual inaccuracies, and move on. And that's how it would be. It's I want to address something because I just brought it up. Is some people talk about this movie and you know, and ask questions, especially when you're in Australia. You know, why are you invested? Why would you be so invested in American politics? And you know, I think I've answered that specifically about this show. But one thing about Trump is his brazen shamelessness has emboldened a lot of the same or similar practices with like conservative leaning politicians around the world, you know, around, and even if it's just approaches to media and fear mongering of, you know, this, what is ultimately there and designed to hold people to account, which is sort of a free media, rather than sort of this propagandistic arms of, you know, conservative power brokers. And so, you know, if people ask why I'm invested, is because Australia never would have had a prime minister like Tony Abbott, who is a flagrant misogynist and homophobe and racist, as the prime minister, had, they would never have elected, and who was also a dullard, would never have elected a person like that had there not been the rise of Trump. You know, had that not all been in the waters around the world with the way that things are sort of going around. You know, he was famously lambasted on the John Oliver show for being a complete dope as well. And so, like, I think that that's the kind of thing when you can be invested, is like, I don't care about the man because he doesn't affect the way that I live necessarily directly, like he would you and many other Americans who are fans of this show and who love this film. But it's like, man, he's emboldened a lot of really, really sort of dark shit that's happening all over the world.
Is that unique to this guy, or a previous, because of America's, you know, cultural imperialism?
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money
at might say. I mean, does this happen every time there's a changing of the guard?
Yeah, sometimes. It's like, it's who, right, is, you know, and it's also about who you butt up against, because as an ally, it's hard not to have more progressive values when there's a huge influential progressive in power in the States. Like with the Barack Obama, if Australia, who's one of its allies, is like, yeah, we're not in for this, you know, climate accord, or we're not in for this thing. It's like, usually, you know, as a key ally, they're like, hey bro, why aren't you with us? You know, like, it's nice to have you with us. You know, how do we get you with us and have that influence? Where it's like, oh yeah, I really like those deplorable, you know, offshore processing centers you have for a potential refugee to your country, Australia. Trump's like, you're dealing with it great. You're just doing great. You know, I don't care if some politicians are going to get taken to the Hague. You know, you guys are doing great. ICE, look at what Australia are doing over in, you know, over in this island over here. This is really good stuff, you know, and that's what's scary, is that, like, when you're butting up against people who've got a bit more of a moral compass and are scientifically minded and aren't in for the bluster and in for the chaos, then it's much harder for, like, a prominent Australian politician, especially the prime minister, to, like, go into the international stage and be against one of our major allies consistently.
Oh boy, I'm sorry.
you don't have to be sorry. What are you sorry for, my friend?
Our footprint's too big sometimes.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's America casts a big shadow. That's why the Dow Jones just jumped 30,000 points, because people are like, oh, thank God, Trump is, like, basically conceding. You know, you know, they're like, Biden is now actually kind of able to, you know, start planning things and do things correctly. And so it's like, oh, well, there will be a transition. And when he's out, America will get this virus under control and we'll have our normal friends back again.
And to be clear, what took place is that, you know, the president-elect was then allowed to know what the vice president-elect was already allowed to know because she's still a sitting senator.
Yes.
And a member of several committees that entitles her to be briefed on these things. So the president, all that took place was an evening of the score between the president-elect and the vice president-elect.
Yeah.
It's just theater of the absurd continually.
It's a good time.
And, you know, four seasons is enough. I'm glad the show is canceled.
It's like, again, exactly as your son said, watching your youngest boy, you know, we've been waiting for can the credits just roll on this already? We don't want the next season. Please, credits roll. That's it. Thank you very much.
We're out of film. And the movie.
I'm sorry. I've been rolling this thing and there's just no film left in the can. We're done. We're completely done. Well, oh, man. But again, this great transition, this great teletype, it's such a great choice. It's just unfathomably good in already what is kind of an unfathomably good movie.
There's a lot happening here symbolically in the minute. You're going from the television, you're going to the typewriter, to them working, and then you're going to the, you know, there's just a few times that we see the work output, right? Yeah. There's just a few times in the movie. You know, there's a couple of like dropping off of the newspapers at the foot of the White House scene.
I love those. Because I feel sorry for that guy. I haven't talked about him, but I feel sorry for that poor bastard. That guy at the gate or whoever it is, that poor foot soldier who has to carry that. Who has to bring in the papers and just watch Nixon's office like shoot the messenger every day. Because I imagine they weren't kind. And then just drop it and get the hell out of there.
He probably by August of 1974, he's just tossing him out the window.
Over the fence.
Armored car.
He's like, please.
Tossing over the fence.
Oh, my God. But,
right. So, you know, and they're working. They're typing. Their work is never ending. And then just, you know, the unending stream of headlines. It's not, it doesn't go straight to the Nixon resigns, you know, which is, I guess, in the last minute.
Yes.
It's just, it's headline after headline after headline. It's almost an avalanche, right? It's just going and going and going.
It's a beautiful thing because the tension, you know, it is, I think what makes it transcendent repeatedly is that even with, I guess, a royal flush in the hand that Ben Bradley has at the end of this movie, knowing that these guys have this information, it's like you still got to play the game and you've still got to go through the process and you still have to do the work every single day and keep up that level of diligence, even though you kind of know where it's at. And I think that, you know, that's why I love these projects, because doing the work of this show, if it does anything for me as a passionate cinephile and as a critic, it's to really underscore literally every single person every craftsperson that has contributed to this and to try and leave no stone unturned with any choice that is being made to execute something that's so rewarding on so many rewatches. It's like the doing the work is the thing. You know, this is the deepest satisfaction that I get, you know, as a viewer and someone who creates these podcasts is like, I can watch this minute, which is gun firing, archival footage, multiple split diopters, a gorgeous dissolve, and then flicking over to a teletype. And I can talk about those six T's that we talked about in televisions and typewriters and then teletypes and then really thick ties and, you know, and the handsome Rob Redford, just in case that we didn't get there. But like all the choices that are being made to really... to wrap it up. And so I think I can feel why people say it's anticlimactic, but for me, it's just the power and the potency is in the repetition and the fluidity that these guys are just there, just emptying this out. It's all there, like actually doing the work is such a goddamn joy.
Right. It's just another day for them, right? Nixon's being re-inaugurated and there's a 21 gun salute and, you know, it's just another day for them. I love the fact that Woodward Redford isn't a touch typist. I mean, he's using, you know, 2-3 fingers and thumbs, basically banging it out.
Yeah.
I just love that touch. I love that, you know, after doing this for as long as he has, his typing isn't really any better.
No. He's 9 months in the newsroom and he's not a touch typer. And you know, based on the prep that Redford watched the real Woodward and it's like, he's not a touch typer. I guess I'm just going to have to do the thing.
It's great.
It's so great. It's a great choice. It's a great movie.
It is.
It's one of the greatest movies ever made.
I think so. I mean, I've watched this movie easily yearly since it was, you know, since I probably first taped it off of HBO. I can't even begin to imagine how many times I've watched this movie, even before your podcast.
Yeah.
You know, when I was trying to catch up and stuff. But, you know, and it's just always been there for me. And, you know, whenever I'm feeling down about the system, I put it on because, I mean, I think I told you in one of our first conversations, this movie is kind of a document of like the last time the whole system worked.
Yeah.
All of the branches of government, the free press, right? Editorial processes, all of it. The whole system worked.
And the power of the party, when they started to dig up these little fiefdoms that Nixon had created within their party because of the way that he controlled who ran the FBI and who was running the intelligence community and who doing all these things, they started to go, you got to go. And then there was internal pressure. So it's not just the journalists in power and their opposition and the different branches of governments. It's the internal party conflicts of the morality of who and of how he's behaving. Because it's like, you can say this all diplomatically, but sir, if you've done this, the American people, this, we can't have this reflect this way in the party anymore. And actually the party holding them to account is another thing that I can't get enough of in this movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just this notion that, no, you've gone too far.
Yep.
You got to go.
You got to go. Too far. Like, and even, you know, the greatest double take in the history of cinema, I'm a Republican.
Yeah.
And often looking at Redford like, what? It's like, yeah, this is a time where two people with completely divergent political beliefs are like, no good.
And they stumble into it, right?
Yeah.
It's got that Hitchcock quality. Reporters stumble into the big conspiracy.
Yeah. They Hitchcock plays with that so well with like North by Northwest. That's probably my favorite version of that. It's just the like fake names and fake. It's all good. Like all like assuming identity. It's all of that stuff is so good. I don't want to get us too deep diving down like North by Northwest and how wonderful that is and how joyful it is. But that's the other quality that this movie has, which is undeniable. It's that it's so goddamn entertaining. Like, you know, as authentic as it is and as meticulously as it curates every part of it, it's just so goddamn entertaining. It knows that it's a movie and that it has to move and it has to entertain you and these personalities have to do it and they make very calculating choices. And I love it. I love that it's freaking entertaining as well.
Yeah. It also has that great effect on me. Like when we get to like this point, it's like I'm really like wistful and nostalgic for the old days of the movie, right? And so it just forces me to like loop it because it's like, you know, I miss the fun of them discovering all this stuff, you know. And you know, you've heard me say we are Woodstein. I miss the fun of like discovering that stuff myself, right?
I
being the invisible sidekick of these two as all this stuff just starts like unfolding in front of them, and they start on peeling it back as well.
You know, after our recent episode 127, where I sort of got to imbue Woodstein, I really miss the beginnings of this movie a lot. Like, I think about them a lot because I watch them so much. And him doing that whole Howard Hunt ring around and finding out that he's in the CIA, and it's just great. It's just so effective. It's just effective storytelling. The CIA. Like, God damn, it doesn't get much better than that. And asking if anyone can speak English and Spanish, it's just like, oh, of course this is a movie that hooks you in. That's like 11 minutes in. You're right into this movie. It's wonderful.
So you know the 6 minute long cut of Woodward on the phone?
Yes. Yes.
Right? Again, it's the slow zoom. It's the split diopter zoom. I think in the commentary, Redford says that scene, he's more proud of that scene than any other acting he's done in his career. Which is, you know, quite a statement from that guy.
Yeah, it is. But it's also like, this is what I can't get my head around. As a producer, he's curating the whole aesthetic and everything, the whole reception of the movie. So imagine then a 6 minute monologue, essentially, where you're carrying the whole movie. And he's never necessarily been the monologue guy. He's Sundance, baby. He just laconically waltzes in. And even in, say, The Candidate, he's not like, he's the hand puppet of Peter Boyle and all those people who are building him. And so him doing that, and just also the degree of difficulty of that scene, now knowing how it was done, you know, for, I've mentioned on a few other episodes for folks who maybe haven't listened before, I'll mention it just really briefly again, is like Steven Soderbergh famously spoke to Gordon Willis about his setup, and Gordon Willis developed this split diopter shot that he could push in and zoom, but he would have to manually adjust the focus. And so many cinematographers were terrified that they would kill the cut because they'd mess up the zoom of the shot, because you had to be doing it live. You had to be editing the zoom and pushing in at the same time to not break the shot. And Gordon Willis was the only guy who could do it. So he actually controlled the camera. And there's Pakula beside you. There's probably people that are, excuse me, playing all the voices on the phone. And this is pushing in, and Gordon Willis himself controlling this mammoth camera, editing it. It's like, to have all of that going and then to nail the scripting, it's like, it's a very high degree of difficulty and extremely special that it all came together.
I really love the fact that Willis was, you know, equally fluent in being a conceptual artist as well as, you know, the practical artist in realizing his vision.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to conceive of the lighting and the camera setups is one thing, to you know, execute on that vision is another, and to have both those qualities in the same person is pretty terrific.
There was a great chat that I had along the way with Monica Castillo, a great film critic and voice in cinema. Excuse me. And she talked about seeing Willis in the flesh and talked about that time that he spoke with Soderbergh. And she's like, what you expect from Willis because of how artful his compositions are and how beautifully tonal they can be and just so dialed into the mood of whatever the picture is that he's creating. You expect him to speak very floridly, like he's an artist, you know? And she said, once, what is striking when you saw him doing this talk about his career was how much of like a pure, humble practitioner he was. He was like, you know, no, this is how you create this functionally, how I could, you know, and his job was translating the vision of the director to make it happen. But also then, as you said, like he's a workman. He was just like a very straight to the point guy. So it's like, it's really funny because I'm, you know, the Gordon Willis that films Deep Throat and illuminates the eyes, those incredible, incredible eyes in the scenes in the garages. That guy feels like he's Van Gogh. He's like, apparently just talks like a plumber. He just, you know, he's just like, oh no, this is how I did it. And this is, you know, this is what we're doing. It's hilariously oxymoronic.
When, you consider his work in Godfather. I mean,
yeah.
The Wedding?
The Wedding. There's maybe not a scene that has breathed more life and continues to breathe life than that scene. That scene is alive. At the beginning of the movie, I Believe in America.
I Believe in America.
Holy shit. Holy shit. I mean, this movie, you know, this movie, Clute, Parallax, The Godfathers. My word. This has been a special movie. This has been a special podcast. It has been special getting to know you and talk to you. And it would be, we have to do one pre-correction because I'm not going to bother correcting it on the show tomorrow. We'll do a pre-correction to say Jane Alexander, the lovely Jane Alexander, was not even aware that John Boorstin had said and what is researched at the Post that they were actually in Bethesda, Maryland, in the former home of bookkeeper Judy Hoback Miller. She hadn't met her, and she wasn't even aware that in this tiny house with this gigantic camera, and you'll hear her talking about in the next episode, that it was actually the home of Judy Hoback Miller. And so when I talked to her, I actually asked, I asked her, was that the house? And she said no, because she wasn't aware. But in fact, it was. So in the final moment of this movie, apart from discussing obviously the final teletype moments and the power and the resonance of the movie, getting to have my own bookkeeper scene. I didn't drink nearly as much coffee. I'm just going to give a spoiler. I wasn't as caffeined up as Hoffman. I hadn't smoked nearly as many cigarettes, but I get to have that bookkeeper scene.
Are you going
to
hide behind the stairway?
I hid behind the Zoom stairway. I pulled up my microphone stand a little bit, it covered my eyes, but I just wanted to say that it has been extremely special talking to you and extremely special getting to know you. And it's been wonderful to have this, the second last chat in this project with you, because I think that, you know, creating these little beacons, and I intended that pun, creating these little beacons of shows that I do, and finding these people across the world that connect with what we do and connect with the movies is exactly why I do it. So Greg, it's a really special thing for me to talk to you, and I'm so glad that you could be a part of the show.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Blake. I've just really, really loved, you know, I mean, your show has been a nightly companion to me, you know, going through the pandemic, doing the dishes in the middle of the night after everyone goes to bed. You know, I'm usually behind an episode or two. And so, you know, it's plenty of time to get everything done. And, you know, just listening to this conversation about this movie that is just, you know, just run through my life. It's been a constant presence in my life. So to have this kind of discussion about it, I think I told you when I first emailed you, I mean, my jaw hit the floor. I couldn't believe that, you know, such a thing would even exist. A minute-by-minute analysis of this movie. So it's been really, I've just enjoyed digging back into it, watching it, and listening to the show. So thank you.
Greg, Christy, truly the show's biggest supporter. Thank you so much for being a part of it, mate. I hope you could actually make it to this outro to hear me say thank you. One episode to go. John Boorstin came on this show, episode 76. We talked about the 75th and 76th minute. We let him cheat because he's an associate producer. He was Alan J. Pakula's assistant on the film. A huge thanks to Justin Chang and Kenny Turin for shouting out to John about the show and John's generosity, his spirit and time to make time to be on the show. But one thing that John said was, the film in microcosm is the bookkeeper scene. That overwhelming pressure to unburden oneself of the truth. So in the final minute of this incredible film, I'm going to talk to a woman who made that moment.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.